Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. In this episode, I speak to someone who you may know as the CVO, that is, of course, the Chief Vegetable Officer of the world famous Value After Hours podcast. It's a guy that Matthew Peterson knows as the Brad Pitt of podcasting.
I was speaking to some of the ladies, and then they were very distracted, and they pointed out that Jake Taylor had just walked in. Oh, I know, he's a great guy, you know. They said, no, he's... No offense, but they said, you know, he's the Brad Pitt of podcasts. Yeah.
I know him as Jake Taylor. He's the CEO of Farnham Street Investments, author of The Rebel Allocator, and founder of the recently launched investment journaling platform, Journalytic. In this episode, we cover a wide range of topics, including Jake's journey from working in the energy industry to transitioning into becoming an investment professional and starting Farnham Street Investments. We also talk through what it was like for him to write and publish his book, The Rebel Allocator, and actually get a completely unexpected 30-minute phone call from Charlie Munger about his book, and Charlie kind of sharing the idea that it should be turned into a movie at some point. We cover the recent launch of Journalytic, an investment journaling platform that's just gone live in the past couple of weeks. We talk through some of Jake's thoughts on oil and Warren Buffett's big bets recently in that space. And finally, I put a couple of audience questions to Jake that were collected over on Twitter. So I really hope you enjoy this episode, but without further ado, let's roll this one with Jake Taylor. Right, attempt two. We had some technical difficulties there, or at least I did. But Jake Taylor is on the podcast. Welcome along, Jake. How's things been with you?
Been great, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I appreciate you making the time. A lot of people will probably be familiar with you from, well, various bits of work you've had on the go. I was kind of preparing for this episode over the past couple of days, and I was like, I knew you from Value After Hours, but I also see you've got the Rebel Allocator book out there. You've recently launched an investment journaling platform. You kind of got a lot of stuff on the go. So I appreciate you making the time. Do you want to tell the people who maybe haven't come across you before how you got into the whole sort of investing world in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. My background was actually, I got an econ degree in undergrad, and then coming out of college, I got a job to basically become an electrical engineer in a short period of time to then run the power grid for the state of California. And after I'd been working there for a couple of years, I happened to enroll in business school, and I was doing like nights and weekends in an MBA program at UC Davis. And my first year in the program, I won this lottery to go back to Omaha and have lunch with Warren Buffett, which he's done with a lot of students over the years. And it was very formative, amazing, as you would expect. And I came back from Omaha wanting, with this desire to learn, how the hell does he have such a thought out answer for every single question?
Yeah.
And as I start, you know, researching and reading into him, I'd kind of always been into investing. Like, I liked saving money. I liked having more money. But I didn't have a particular approach, I wouldn't say. I just mostly owned mutual funds. And I was probably just chasing momentum more than anything, if I was being honest. But when I read more about Buffett, and, you know, then of course that leads you to Munger and Graham and all these other, you know, amazing investors, I realized, oh, okay, they just want to get a good deal when they buy something. And I had always been wanting to get a good deal when I bought something. And I just didn't know that when you did it in the context of partial ownership of businesses, that was called value investing. And so it just made perfect sense to me and fit in with, you know, my whole worldview before that, basically. And it was like that clicking, you know, that inoculation that Buffett talks about. So I continued to work at the energy place for quite a while I worked my way into transitioning into finance. So it was a very, you know, backdoor. I never worked at a bank. I never worked, Goldman or anything like that. I interned at another hedge fund that was run by my boss at the time at the energy place, who also happened to be a big Buffett fan. But otherwise, right. And like, you know, he never worked in any of those places either. So it was really just the two of us basically trying to figure it out, but always kind of working from first principles and what did we learn from Buffett. And so I probably avoided a lot of bad habits that I could have learned working at a bigger place, but I also, you know, they figured out some things that work well there, and I had to learn a lot of those the hard way, probably. So, you know, it's as anything, there's trade-offs.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like, because in the broader like investing and finance community, value investing is still like remarkably niche. So, do you think there were quite a few advantages to sort of stumbling into it as opposed to going through formal education and that type of thing?
Probably in that it probably helped me to focus on the businesses and less about what is the market doing or saying, or, you know, what are the analyst projections about something. None of that stuff is that germane to my process. I'm much more trying to think about the business and where is it going and can I wrap my mind around that. And that stays very center focused. And I think that is actually a really big advantage in the investment game, and probably one that I inherited through accident more than anything.
Yeah, very cool. And how would you describe sort of your investment philosophy today? And has that evolved over time since first getting kind of the inoculation, or has it remained fairly similar over the years?
No, it's definitely evolved. And, you know, when I first started out, I was very, very quantitatively driven because I just did not trust myself. You know, part of having that no real background, I didn't trust myself to have any of these type of insights about businesses or, you know, opportunities. And so it was very, very much like, okay, what do the numbers say? Let's try to buy, you know, a basket of low price to book or even net nets if they're available. And of course, that was one of the problems, was that, you know, that worked for a little while, but then really a lot of those started to dry up, and it was really hard to find anything that was that quantitatively cheap. So then what do you do? And so I am now, like, I would call my current approach opportunistic, if I had to put it into one word. And, you know, unfortunately, that doesn't fit very well into, you know, a Morningstar style box. So it's, you know, it's not like it's an institutionally attractive idea. But I think that most of the time, the market has the right price for most businesses. I think it's actually really hard to find mispriced businesses. But every once in a while, there will be something that is just so obviously the wrong price that if you can be patient enough to wait until those times come, then I think you actually don't have to be this, you know, amazing all-star business analyst to recognize it and be able to take advantage of it. You just have to be patient though. And you can't there are less of those ideas out there than I think maybe we always would want to admit. And so a lot of times it's very easy to talk yourself into things. And I needed a maturation process of really understanding businesses better after studying them for, you know, more than a decade. I needed to understand myself better, actually, which is a huge part of it. Like, where am I likely to trip myself up? And can I, like, do anything to structurally stop that from happening? I'm kind of stepping on the toes a little bit of the software project, because that was really a big impetus for it. But opportunistically, every once in a while, there's things that are just no-brainers that you can take advantage of. And that's what I'm just looking for and waiting around for.
Yeah, I like it. And so when you say opportunistic, does that mean you're still open to like the net nets, cigar butts, as well as the better quality businesses, but of all sorts? Or?
I would be. One, they haven't, like, they are very rare when they come around. And chances are there is probably a higher quality business that I feel like I might understand that would be so dislocated from price that I would want to own for a longer period of time, that I probably would go more towards that. And the difference would be, you know, when you buy, if you're a net kind of hunter, you really have to turn the portfolio over a lot. And ideally, you're always upgrading into, you know, another batch of net nets. But given that they are not this, you know, they're not available all the time, you know, that can be really difficult. And a lot of times, you know, I could buy a higher quality company and then own it for 10 years instead of worrying about turning it over in, you know, 12, 18, 24 months. And that's just more attractive to me. I don't know if you get older and lazier or what it is, but like when you could find the quality business and it's really on sale, it's harder for me to pass that up now because I know that it's sort of solving a problem for myself for a long period of time. Like I have a duration that it's attractive to me now.
Yeah, sure. And I guess, well, this will vary, I guess, where you are in the world, but there's presumably a lot of tax advantages to that. And you have to be right less times, I suppose.
I think, yes, you have to be right less times, but I think you actually, what are you really being right about? So in, let me back up a little bit. Like, what do I mean by that? If I am picking one individual business and I'm concentrating in it in a way that, you know, it's going to be meaningful, I have to really be right about that business over a long period of time. Like I have to have some insights into that. What am I, if I'm a net hunter, what am I being right about? I am likely to be right about reversion to the mean of super cheap assets where the return profile of that basket is such that it probably looks like several losers, like probably bankrupt, a bunch in the middle that don't do anything, and then a couple that are just such wild successes that they carry the entire return for that portfolio. So I'm, what I have to be right about is that the world will look the same and the statistical statistical relationship between cheap assets and what they have done in history will hold. And that's what I'm really betting on, is reversion to the mean, and that this population of stocks, if you can buy them for cheap enough, will provide you the outcome that has historically happened when you've been able to buy things of that nature. So that's what you're really sort of like implicitly betting on.
Got it. And so you started out in kind of the energy industry, kind of got into value investing. What did the transition look like, kind of going to essentially full-time investor and starting Farnham Street?
Painful. I don't know. Is the you know, I worked both jobs for up until 2015. So I started Farnham Street in 2010. So it was a good 5 years of building a business while also working a full-time corporate job running the power grid. So it was a lot. Had a couple kids too at the same time. I don't know exactly sure how I pulled it all off in that time frame, but somehow I survived and was able to make the transition, thankfully.
Yeah. And was that really just kind of a game of sort of building enough assets under management to be able to make it kind of viable? Is that really what that was about?
Right. I mean, I had a mortgage to pay. I had, you know, children to feed. So I needed to build a business up. I had to be like Tarzan, where you don't let go of one vine until you're holding onto the other vine firmly.
Yeah, fair enough. So tell us a bit about Farnham Street and kind of the fund that you're running there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very boutique, small firm that is basically someone who's interested in Farnham Street just wants to have their portfolio look like how I manage my own portfolio. And that's the only thing that we really have going for us is like that alignment of interest. So I manage my own money in this way, and there's enough friends and family and people now that have reached out that want a similar treatment of what I do to my own money. And that's basically what I give them there.
Very cool. And do you operate as sort of a largely one man band with the investment process? Do you have a team around you? How does that work?
Yeah, I have some support team, and it's not a one man show. But I also have, you know, a really good network of friends who are terrific investors, probably better than I am. And that allows me to find new interesting ideas to work on and run ideas and industries past people who know way more about them than I do and help me get caught up on them. And so, you know, the whole network outside of just like people who work with me in there is super valuable for me in being able to process information and hopefully not like waste too much time.
Mm-hmm. How was the transition for you going from managing your own money to managing other people's money? Was that a mental hurdle that took some getting over, or is that something you've been reasonably comfortable with from the start?
Yeah, there's only been a couple of accounts, and they were very early on, and they were bigger accounts, where I was like, oh my gosh, I'm really nervous to be taking over this. Mm-hmm. One of them was a very good friend of mine, and this was like his entire net worth. And or well, I mean, it was like his entire retirement account, and it was a meaningful, very meaningful to him. And the idea that I could mess that up gave me, you know, gave me some, a little bit of jitters. But, you know, that can also be a forcing function to make you really pay attention and not take undue risk. And, I, you know, the last thing I wanted in the world was to lose his money. So, you know, if you start with Buffett's rule number one about like, don't lose money, to have that, that dreadful feeling of potentially, you know, ruining a friend's financial situation, like that's a pretty good forcing function to work hard and do a good job.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And do you find that because of that, you manage the portfolio slightly different now to how you might have done if it was just personal accounts?
Yeah, I think the key difference is that, you know, a lot of the investment world is representative of a sleeve for someone. So like what I mean by that, like this is the strategy for small cap value, and they have a manager for that. And then that you're the manager of that strategy that you're working with that client, and they have 5% of their assets in there. And they want you to stick to small cap value and like don't deviate because they have a bigger plan that you're just a little component of.
Right.
I tend to have more clients where I'm in charge of the whole thing. And so when it looks like that, like you have to really make more holistic kind of decisions around it and not get too stuck in any one particular, you know, area or take undue risks. And it really, I think it makes you really like not worry, like you don't want to blow the whole thing up. And so I think a lot of times managers, like what, when they're working on like, it's part of their career, right? Like, so it might actually be smart of them to take more risk in their portfolios because that really works out. They get a lot more assets, and now all of a sudden, like they can be a big deal in the industry, right? And if it doesn't work out, like, oh shoot, you know, maybe I'll just start another fund later. I'll wait a little while. Yeah. Like you see that happen all the time.
Yeah.
But blowing them up, blowing that client up and their money is, you know, it's bad, but like when it's only 5% of the assets, they can kind of live with that. But if I'm blowing up 100% of someone's assets, like I couldn't live with that. So it creates a much different dynamic when you have the entire thing, as opposed to when you only have like a little sliver of it.
Mm-hmm. How does that, I guess, how do you approach like communication with your investors? Because I would imagine if you've got the full net worth, I imagine you've got people paying reasonably close attention to what you're doing from time to time. And, you know, sure, particularly in volatile markets, that can create some interesting kind of situations. Are you one of these guys that are like, you know, I'll write you a letter once a year and please leave me alone the rest of the time? Or how do you tend to manage that whole thing?
Yeah, I'm a little bit that way. In that I think it's in their best interest as well that you know, have time to focus on what really moves the needle for them. But I, you know, I'm not that unapproachable. Like I don't hide from them. Mm-hmm. I write a quarterly letter to update. But yeah, I think what I try to do actually, I think in this case, it's the ounce of prevention is worth the pound of cure. And so on the front end, before anyone becomes a client, I'm vetting them to make sure that there's a match. And most of the time it's about timelines. Like, are they looking like are they optimizing over a similar long timeline like I am? And if not, then that's not a good match for us to work together. So I, you know, I want to find that out sooner than later, as opposed to just take on as many assets as I can and then let the ones who are unhappy leave. Like that would feel very bad for me. And so I want to give myself the best chance at doing a good service for them. And that requires that we're all talking in the same like durations.
Mm-hmm. I like it. Cool. Well, moving on a little bit here, I want to chat a little bit about a book you wrote a little while back, the Rebel Allocator.
Sure.
Can you tell us a little bit, I guess, what was it like writing a book and going through that whole process in the first place? and then I want to loop around to someone who was quite a fan of the book that everyone listening to this will know. We'll maybe come to that later. But what was that kind of writing process like?
It's terrible. I mean, I think the saying is that everyone wants to have written a book, but no one really wants to write a book. Mm-hmm. And I believe that to be very true. It was very hard for me. It was years of difficult work. And I don't know if it's because I tried to do something that was very out of the ordinary, in that this book is a fictional story about this kind of a coming of age, younger person who's learning about the world and about business, and meets this mentor who's helping them to understand things. And the thing that they're trying to understand is actually like capital allocation. So you start off with a very esoteric subject like capital allocation, and then you combine it with a fictional story. And, you know, when you lay it out like that, you say like, well, who the hell is ever going to write a book like that? Like it's idiotic. And that was how I felt for large periods of the project. But for whatever reason, I felt like I had to tell a story to really have it resonate and have people remember the lessons that I was hoping that they would learn. And at the end of the day, it was really, I just wanted to actually teach like smaller business people and younger business people how to assign where resources go. How do they spend money inside of their business? And how can they do that in a way that is intelligent? And that's really like, I start at the very ground level of expenses and work my way up all the way into, you know, more difficult to understand concepts like within cap allocation, like buybacks and dividends and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, you combine all this together and it seems like who the hell would ever write this book? It's insane. But I just kept pushing forward, and eventually I just put it out. I had no idea what to expect. And that was the feedback that I got was just so lovely and so nice from so many people, like shockingly awesome, like people who I would have never thought would have read it and sent me nice letters. Like, I don't want to name names, but like, just, I couldn't believe it. And including a call, which you referenced too.
Yeah. Well, let's name one name, which is Charlie Munger. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah. I was just in my office one day, a few months after the book came out, and my assistant tells me that I have a call and that it's Charlie Munger. And I was like, come on, don't mess with me. That's not funny. But then turns out it was Charlie Munger, and he just wanted to talk about the book and actually thought it would be awesome if I made it into a movie. And it was one of the most surreal 30 minutes of my life to talk to one of my heroes about a book that I wrote that I wasn't sure anyone would ever read.
Yeah, that's absolutely insane. You must have thought it was like Bill or Toby messing with you or something.
I thought for sure somebody was messing with me. Like, yeah, what are the chances? I mean, just so seems so vanishingly small.
Yeah. Is there anything else you're happy to share kind of from that call with Charlie?
Well, you know what? Probably the weirdest part of it, the whole thing, was that, this was like 2019-ish, and I had been lamenting in my quarterly letters to clients that I was having a hard time finding things to buy at that point that made sense to me. Those no-brainers that I talked about, you know, being opportunistic about. And he told, apparently Charlie had gone back and read some of my letters, because he said, you know, I'd be more worried about you if you were finding lots of good ideas right now. So somehow, I don't know, he found time to read some of my letters as well before we chatted on the phone, which is even probably a smaller chance that ever happened than the book. So
yeah, that's got to feel absolutely insane. Do you know how how he stumbled across you, or did you send him the book, or do you know how that all actually started?
Yeah, I did send him a copy of the book. I sent it to, you know, people who were influential, because he's a, like this main, the kind of, well, actually, so just to back up a little bit, like the book is modeled basically after The Karate Kid as the storyline would play out, except imagine, you know, that Daniel-san is trying to learn about capital allocation from Mr. Miyagi. And so the old, you know, Mr. Miyagi character is an amalgamation of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger and, you know, a bunch of my business heroes basically kind of rolled into one. And like, what would they say if they were asked these questions by someone who's younger and just trying to learn the ropes?
Very cool. How did that idea for taking that approach to writing an investment book actually start?
Well, you know, I originally sketched out a nonfiction book, as you'd probably expect for a topic like capital allocation. And it just seemed like it was going to be so boring. Like, I couldn't even want to read it. And so that was, you know, looking for stories as a way to make it more interesting. One day I was just sitting and thinking like, well, who's good at telling stories? And I thought, well, Hollywood, right? So I actually read a couple books on screenplays, and then I used what I learned in that screenplay writing books to then sketch out, you know, like actually like scene by scene of the book of how it would play out. Like I had it on like 3x5 index cards, you know, as you would do a screenplay. And so that was how the flow of the story was sort of constructed. And then I could just sprinkle the lessons within there to have like a building up of knowledge for the main character.
Love it. And do you feel like that's a project you'll ever, you know, is there going to be a Rebel Allocator 2? Or you feel like you've ticked that off and you're happy that you've achieved?
It'd be real, really difficult because that book had, you know, 20 years worth of things that I'd stumbled across that I thought were smart and interesting, and I, you know, condensed down into that story. It's going to take me so long to fill that hopper back up to where I could feel like I had anything that was remotely as important. And maybe it's possible I might never, because of just sort of the law of diminishing returns. Like I probably found most of the important things already. Mm-hmm. That the idea of getting as much of that again filled up is like so daunting. It's hard to imagine doing it again.
Yeah, fair enough. I asked William Green a very similar question about Ritualizer Happier 2.0. And yeah, there was sort of like a look of horror that just went across his face around how daunting that would be. It's like 20 plus years of interviews, you know, into 300 pages.
Yeah. Same issue that I would feel if I tried to tackle that project.
Yeah, 100%. Well, let's roll into another venture of yours. You've got quite a few things on the go here, Jack. You're rocking the Journalytic t-shirt at the moment. I know Journalytic is something you've been working on for quite a while at the moment, and you've just recently launched. And I was having to play around with the platform a couple of days ago, and it looks pretty cool. I've seen a lot of people chatting on Twitter about it. Feedback so far seems like overwhelmingly positive. So tell us about what Journalytic is, and what's the journey been like to get to this point?
Yeah, a few years ago, I had felt like I just felt very disorganized. Like I had notes all over the place. I had yellow notepads stuffed full of things. Like some of my notes would be at the office, some would be at home. And I was like, I just need to get more organized. And so like I started looking, I tried out a bunch of different tools, like different note-taking apps. And after a while, I was like, gosh, how come there's not one that's just like good for investors? Like how come nobody's built something for investors? Because there are certain things that we do and record that are common amongst all of us, but yet they don't really exist in a kind of a note-taking way. And so I wanted to get more organized. And when I started like thinking through like what would this kind of look like, I realized, oh man, like there's probably a lot of other people who feel like I do about this. The other couple things that was really important to me, I wanted to figure out was I wanted to hold myself more accountable. So like I ended up, you know, like I have all these best intentions. Like I research a company and then like I'll forget about it for a while and then I'll move on to something else. And, you know, just like it's really easy to not hold yourself accountable. And then the other thing was that like there were just a lot of things I wanted to know about my own investment process that I wasn't capturing. Like how many ideas did I look at this year? Like how many things did I pass on? What were the reasons that I bought or sold something? And is there any commonalities between those reasons? And like, how do they all go on to do? Like, there's all this stuff that I wasn't keeping track of that I felt like, gosh, it'd be really cool to know that about myself, but it's just such a pain in the ass to like keep track of it. And that's sort of what software is good at, right? Is like, how do we make something repeatable so that we can close that feedback loop and tell you, you know, like what were the consequences of all these actions and decisions? And so after a while, I was like, man, this might actually be a legit product all on its own. Like, I kind of want to just build it for myself so that I can use something to get better. But it felt like might be able to help so many other people. And so that was when I started building a team around it and, you know, hiring employees and really actually like scaling it out into building something legit. And instead of just my own little like personal, you know, Jake's notes type of thing that was, you know, living on my own computer. And that was, you know, bringing these other people in has totally made it like a million times better than if I was just in charge of doing it. I'm super blessed with a couple co-founders that are better than me in a million different ways. And our employees are awesome. And it's been really satisfying and interesting to learn how to make software. I was totally blind to that coming into it. I've never, you know, I knew zero about it. And so that's been a really interesting learning curve to try to just barely get up that first little bit of it. But it's been a really fun project and really satisfying. And I think that we're going to end up helping a lot of people with it eventually. I mean, already starting, but I think as the word sort of gets out and spreads and the other things that we can build for them, I think it's going to be like a pretty big deal for improving investment processes for everybody.
Yeah. And how long a journey has it been to get to this point? I know I mentioned it very briefly before we started recording here, but I work in a software business in my day job and also had zero software background before going into that job, I should say. So yeah. I've since learned that software development can occasionally be much slower and more expensive than you might initially imagine. So what's that journey been like for you?
Those are very true words.
So I
think I made the joke on Twitter that there are different levels of kind of forcing functions of learning something. There's, you're just kind of interested in it and you poke around and like read books about it. And then there's actually like teaching a class about something. So we didn't mention this, but I taught at UC Davis after I graduated a class on value investing for 4 years. And that was a great forcing function for me to learn all kinds of stuff about investing. And then there's writing a book about something. That's an amazing forcing function to make you learn because you really start to understand where your holes are when you have to explain it to someone else in that type of, at that depth. And then at the very bottom of this, where it's the most painful and like the hardest forcing function is software around that idea. And so I'm like in Dante's levels of hell, you know, like getting deeper and deeper into like the forcing functions of like really making you understand something. And I've, you know, this is my new depth is software. But it's amazing. Like just even figuring out like, where should this button go can be an arduous process. It's unbelievable.
Yep. Been there. Yeah. Should this be a radio button or a slider or a yes, no? And
100%.
What color should it be?
Oh my gosh. Colors are like the bane of my existence, but yeah.
Yeah. And are you able to share some of the early insights you've had out of using Journalytica? I understand you've been using it personally for 18 months-ish. Is that about
right?
Yeah,
that's right. So like, you know, and obviously I was using a rudimentary version and like, you know, every day it has new features that are, you know, increasing the value proposition. But some of the things I've really like that's really made a difference for me is one, being able to search across all my notes is really valuable. And I use a lot of tagging in my notes. So it's, you know, you like a hashtag and then some idea, you know, energy stocks I'm looking at, like I'll use energy tag, or I use it actually a fair amount for scoring. So like, let's say I'm reading a 10Q and I see like something that kind of bothers me. I'll put in a red flag hashtag. And that's just, you know, it one by itself doesn't mean anything, but I can then go back and look at that idea and all my notes on that idea really easily. And I could see like, oh man, like there's been red flags starting to accumulate for 6 months. I wasn't aware of it in real time, but like they're really starting to build up. I need to probably re-underwrite this, think through it a little bit more. Similarly, green flag I use as well for things that I like. And then I can go back and look and see, and I'm literally just looking for red and green then through my notes to see like how are things changing. And so it kind of zooms you out a little bit compared to when you're like you're in the weeds so much in the investment process that getting out and seeing some meta layer of data, I think, is really helpful. And then scoring things like, you know, capital allocation or culture or whatever, like I'll use tagging to score things so that I can kind of keep track of like who do I think is doing good things through different lenses. So that's been super helpful, is just like getting that external brain built so that I don't have to keep it all in RAM up here in my head where it's really like super lossy and it's not a good system. I can only store so much. The processing sucks. Getting that outsourced into software is really valuable. And then, you know, I actually did recently for myself a little decision review. So I looked at all of my decisions that I made and I separated them out into buy and sell, hold, and pass. And I looked at every single reason code that I used for every decision over the last 18 months. And then I could start to see it's really easy in our reports section of the software to it'll categorize them based on what you called it and then give you a summed return for that particular reason code. So like all the times that I passed on this particular reason on, you know, X number of companies, I could see how that went on to perform. And so what that's doing, like, you know, let's say in the pass instance, I'm starting to get a sense of what my filtration system is doing for me. Like, what are the tags that are helping or the reason codes that are helping or hurting me when I'm sorting through this stuff? And then closing that feedback loop. And ideally, when I get enough data built, I'm going to know where are my systematic biases for particular ideas and reasons that I use, and how are they helping or hurting me? So it's all just a bunch of stuff like that that's in the program that is tying those feedback loops so that you can just learn faster about yourself and then improve your investment process. Like I said, after using it now for quite a while, like I'm getting new insights all the time into my own process that I was hoping were going to happen, but they're like starting to come faster and faster as the data set builds up. So it's pretty fun. I mean, one of the issues that we have with the software is that when you first get in there, it's kind of like, oh man, what do I do? Right? Like, should I record this? Or, you know, it's like you have the blank page problem that you've always faced if you ever go to write something. But I know at the end of the rainbow, there is this pot of gold for people who put in the work. And so like helping them bridge that from, gosh, I don't know where to start to, oh my God, I'm getting all these insights. It requires some work on their part. And how do we help people to feel good about doing that work and to get excited about it and to stick with it and create that habit that will lead to it. So we have a ton of stuff to still figure out, but so far so good as far as users.
Yeah. And what are maybe one or two kind of early things you've learned about your own investment process that might have surprised you from using the platform?
Well, I mean, specifically about that reason code analysis, there were a couple that were like sort of funny to me. So one of them was I had, why did I buy something? And one of the reasons codes that I used was asymmetric. Okay. So that just means like low possible downside, high possible upside. And when I looked at that reason code for all the ideas on there, like it was bad. Like there was a lot of losers in that code.
Right.
And I was like, oh, maybe I have asymmetry backwards. Maybe these were all like high downside possible and low, you know, minimal upside. Another one was increasing certainty, actually. Like, so like some new data point came out that made me feel more certain about the business. And so I used that as a reason code to add to a particular, you know, several names. And that didn't work out very well as the results so far. But I mean, there's a whole bunch of other ones. A lot of those are all my own reason codes too. So that's what's been interesting in building this, is that there are so many, everyone has their own process and everyone is so idiosyncratic. I mean, we've done hundreds of user feedback interviews to like see how people are using it. And I don't think any of them are the same. Like they're all bespoke investment processes. And so to build software that allows for that kind of expression of flexibility has definitely been a challenge, but is also kind of fun and exciting to think about, like, how are other people using it and how, like, what would, can that do for my own investment process? Like, what am I not thinking about that they are? So, you know, just like anything, like you dig into it so deeply that you just really start to learn about where all the boundaries are and, you know, what, how do things actually work?
Mm-hmm. And so where to next for the platform? I mean, you've just, kind of launched in the past couple of weeks or so, I think. Sounds like you're already getting lots of really good feedback on kind of what's in there so far, but also a lot of Jake, please build this for me. This would be really nice requests. So
yeah.
What's your thoughts on all that so far?
I mean, there's this saying that startups, they drown, they don't starve. And you know, that you could feel like that when you get so much feedback coming in, like you're just gonna drown in all this feedback. So a big part of the lift is to synthesize all of that that's coming in and figure out like what are the common issues, what are the common problems that people want solved. And then really, like, I'm a big fan of the jobs to be done framework. I don't know if you've come across that before in your software writing. No. I mean, the basic idea is to like really think about what is it exactly that the user is wants to accomplish, and how can you actually make them the hero of this story? And so the, like, there's this classic example that I think helps explain it. Imagine a Snickers bar, and the Snickers bar is actually designed to clump up in your mouth and feel like bulky so that it feels like you're eating something substantial. And the reason for that is that the job to be done for the Snickers bar is that you, like, you want to solve your hunger. Like, you're not you when you're hungry. Like, that's all the like commercials and stuff, right? So the job to be done is like, I'm hungry and I want to put a, you know, I want to solve that problem. Now contrast that with a Milky Way, which is also a candy bar, but it is designed to melt in your mouth and feel smooth and viscous. And the idea behind that is it's supposed to feel luxurious. And the whole idea of the, like, the job to be done of a Milky Way bar is to take a break and kind of give yourself a treat. And so you have two candy bars that you, you know, hold up next to each other, and you wouldn't really like, what's the difference, but they're trying to do completely different things for the person who's eating it. So, you know, you try to apply that same like job to be done, like what is the, what's the end human goal? What's the want or need that they have, and work backward from there as to like, how can the tool do this for them? So that's what I'm trying to untangle, is like, what are the jobs to be done here for everybody to, that like is really going to make them the hero of this? Like, they're going to be so happy with the process that, that, you know, they're, you know, it becomes like they wouldn't imagine wanting to do it without that because it's so helpful for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I get what you're saying. I think, you probably get feedback like, you know, can you add this button or this report or whatever, but, yeah, I guess focusing on what people are actually trying to get out of that particular exercise may be better informed. So like the,
and the, you know, it's decisions, right? It's difficult because I, you know, you have all of their feedback, but I also have some like pretty strong visions on my own of thinking about this problem for a really long time and stuff that I know I want to use personally. And so like, I try to bake a fair amount of that into the process as well. Like, there's just like some cool stuff that I think that there's enough people like me who would like it that, like one of the issues you have if you only bring in the user feedback is they're kind of all just going to tell you that they want a faster horse. And I might be saying like, listen, I think I know how to make a car and we can stop worrying about horses. But blending those two things together in the right proportions is, I think, some of the art and of having a startup and doing it right.
Yeah. Do you think going through this journey of, kind of software startup has taught you any lessons for outside of the insights kind of coming from Journalytic and that sort of thing, you know, taught you anything about software businesses or business in general that can be applied to other areas of investing for you?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's the classic Buffett, you know, quote about he's a better businessman because he's an investor, and a better investor because he's a businessman. And so learning about software, learning what the metrics are that are probably the most important to keep your eye on. Actually just having a better appreciation for how slow and hard and difficult things are to execute. Like, I knew that a little bit already. A few years ago, I was involved in a turnaround of a private company, and I saw how messy it was. Like, I knew that business is slow and messy because there's humans involved, but I have an even better appreciation for that. And, you know, I think a lot of times us as investors looking from the outside in on a business, we're like, why is this taking so long to fix this problem? Like, everybody knows it's a problem. Like, what the hell is this management team doing here? Like, it's so obvious how to fix it. And, you know, as an outsider, it does feel easy, but when you're on the inside of it, it's much harder to solve. And there's, you know, there's more complications than you can recognize. There are more dynamics, you know, power dynamics, things happening. It's just more complicated and more kludgy and just way harder when you're on the inside. So I have a better appreciation for that and maybe a little bit more patience for other operators who I'm assessing as an investor.
Yeah. Yeah. I've said that before, having outside of YouTube and podcast investing and things, I work in the agricultural industry, which is like notoriously capital intensive because you own a bunch of farmland, obviously. Yeah. And, you know, when I was first kind of getting introduced to investing, you'd hear people say things like, oh, if a business produces more than a 10% return on equity, that means you've got a great management team. And that's not necessarily the case. Like, sometimes like superstar farm managers, for example, might generate like a 7% return on capital or something.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of about as good as it gets. And then you might have, you know, a ham sandwich running Coca-Cola or whatever Buffett said back in the day, generating great returns on capital. So,
yeah, Buffett said before that if you want to be known as a good businessman, like go into a good business.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. Any last thoughts for now on Journalytic? Or I guess if people are keen to check it out, where can they go to see that?
Yeah, journalytic.com, JOURNALYTIC. Mm-hmm. I think I spelled that right.
Yep.
What I would encourage is create an account and then just go in and for one idea that you have, whatever business you've been thinking about lately, click on the little action button there, which is where we have like special things that are over and above just a journaling app. These are very investment specific things that you can do in there that are all informed by the best practices of decision-making science from the, you know, Kahneman and Malbosin and Phil Tetlock and Annie Duke, all of these like amazing thought leaders in this, all of that stuff is like was the fingerprints on how Journalic was designed if you actually like dig into it. So go into that little action tab after you create your account and click the capture a feeling and just record your feeling about one particular business that you've been thinking about. And then after you post it, go and look at the, click on that idea, like whatever it is. Let's say it was Berkshire. You put in, you know, $BRK, B or A, however rich you are. And then look at the price chart that it'll then show you on that page, and you'll see your journal entry and your mood, your feeling recorded on that price chart and overlaid on it. And then imagine yourself looking forward and seeing like all the notes that you've taken on that company, all the feelings that you've recorded overlaid on the price chart through time. And that, so my Journalytic now looks like that. Like I can go and look at the price chart and I have all these overlays of journal entries to see what was I thinking at different points. So put yourself in a little bit of a future cast to imagine what it's going to be like if you did put in that effort. And hopefully maybe that's enough to like kickstart a little bit of a habit on it and maybe wanting to get recording with your thoughts and your feelings.
Yeah. And I can attest to that. I went and did that exact same thing for a stock I've been in for 3 or 4 years now. I kind of tried to think back in my mind about what I was thinking at various points in time and tracked across, kind of across the charts. Very cool kind of reporting and stuff starting to come out of there.
Well, I think what's going to end up happening is we're going to see, a lot of people are going to see, and myself, I've seen it already, is that price changes drive your sentiment like nothing else. So, you know, if the price of whatever it was that you bought is down, you feel bad about it. And every new data point that comes in, you kind of have a little bit of a negative tinge over it. And you know, it's like sorting that out and keeping reality coming in without being tainted by how you feel about it from recent price action is really hard to do unless you're hypercognizant of it. And so this price chart is hopefully helping you to understand a little bit of how your feelings have been changing over time as the price has been changing. So you can see that about yourself.
Yeah, which is really strange because, you know, we're all supposed to be stone cold rational value investors that love the price going down, but it doesn't seem to come out in the data.
Well, you know what? The thing that's so shocking for me has always been that you hear Daniel Kahneman talking, and he's been studying this stuff since like the late 70s. Like his prospect theory came out, I think they published it in 1982. Okay, so he's been thinking about it for decades, and he still says that he falls prey to all of these biases as much as anybody does. So what do we take away from that? I think we just have to be super focused on using tools to help de-bias us as much as we can. And ideally, like the fully built out, you know, like visionary version of Journalic that's in my head is a total counterbalance to all of those biases and helps you to disentangle that part of it while still being able to do good research. So, you know, having the tools available to de-bias ourselves, I think is actually going to be like a really big deal and maybe even eventually, hopefully table stakes. Like you wouldn't like recognizing we have a problem is the first thing. And then after that, we can try to figure out how to solve it.
Love it. Jake, I want to switch tech slightly. You mentioned towards the start of the episode here, you've got quite the background in the energy business. And I kind of want to talk to you about what Buffett's been doing in that space and kind of maybe energy more generally and what's kind of been going on there. We've seen, you know, Buffett buy a whole bunch of Oxy and Chevron, and oil's been super volatile, as of a bunch of other kind of energy commodities and things. What's kind of take on Buffett's recent purchases in that industry?
Yeah, I mean, I should preface the whole conversation that my background was electricity specifically. Mm-hmm. So, and I did an internship in college that was actually around natural gas. But otherwise, like, you know, there are billions of people who know more about the oil industry than me, most likely. So, but I will say that I can really only speak, I don't know exactly what Buffett is thinking, but like, I know personally for me, you know, back in 2020, oil prices were negative. People were filling their swimming pools up with oil because there was nowhere to put it. And there was all this ESG baggage around oil and energy, and they couldn't get capital. Like, there was all of these reasons to hate energy and a slowing economy too. Like, we stopped the economy. Like, that's literally, we're not burning as many hydrocarbons. But I found it incredibly easy to buy energy stocks at that point. And the reason being was that there's all the market psychology part of it, which we just talked about, like why it would be so negative with ESG and, you know, like negative prices, and all these companies had been burning capital for numbers of years at that point. But that is exactly the situation that leads to less competition, leads to higher prices eventually, leads to higher returns on equity for those type of businesses. And so, I mean, that's what you should really be looking for. Like, that's the blood in the streets. And the key differentiation is that you have to know that it's not an obsolescent product or industry. Like, this wasn't wagon wheels in 19. So, and how did I get comfortable with that part? Well, just the sheer physics, like that our part, I did enough research on to understand like how much of the world is dependent upon hydrocarbons. Our modern world runs on hydrocarbons. I mean, we are, it's shocking if you actually dig into some of the work by like Vlachov Smil has done a lot of this. He's a professor that is also, he writes really prolifically, and this is Bill Gates' favorite author. But he's written entire books about energy. And if you read them, you're like, oh my God, it's going to take so long for us to get off of energy. Like, there's no way we're getting off of hydrocarbons anytime soon. So I felt very comfortable that we were not getting off anytime soon. And therefore I could buy comfortably when there was blood in the streets and when the sentiment was so negative. Now today it's a little bit harder because the price has gone up a lot, obviously. We're still not like back up to 2008 highs. Like 2008, we got over 150 per barrel. You know, we got over, you know, we ran up over 100 and now we're back down below that now. But those companies are earning reasonable returns on equity today. They're reasonably profitable. They're still, you know, reasonably cheap in that I think the market is saying we don't believe that this is going to be sustainable. We think that oil prices are going to come back down, or that you guys are going to get stupid and, you know, spend a bunch of CapEx and start competing with each other again like you used to. And they're probably right over a long enough timeline. Just the question is, like, the bet that you have to get clear in your mind with this now is how long does it take for that rationality, you know, or really irrationality in cooperation between them and not expending a bunch of CapEx. How long can that go on? How long can good returns on equity last? You know, you take a company like Chevron even, you know, you look at last time that oil was kind of working, you know, that was 2011-ish. They, at that point, were earning 25 to 30% returns on equity and getting 3x price to book for the company. You know, that's still a ways away from where we are today. I'm not saying that you should always wait to get peak, you know, peak earnings, peak valuation. But I don't know. Like, I think Buffett recognizes the capital allocation specifically at Oxy and the fact that the free cash flow is not going to be going back into more CapEx. It's going to be going to buybacks. And So he's just picturing he's just going to own an increasing amount of this company if he just does nothing from here. So that's kind of my general take. I may or may not be that helpful, but there's everyone has to kind of make their own decisions, and you know, it's not investment advice, I should say.
yeah, for sure. No, that is helpful. I mean, the handful of different oil company conference calls I've kind of listened through over the past few quarters, the theme is like unbelievably consistent across the board of, you know, we're going to spend a little bit on CapEx, but next to nothing. And we're just going to buy back stock and pay dividends or repay debt. And to an extent, I think that probably reinforces the idea of oil prices might sustain at higher levels for a longer period of time, because no one's going out and looking for oil anymore. I think you might have said on the Value After Hours podcast maybe a week or so ago, it seems like the treadmill's kind of running at max speed in terms of oil supply. Like, there's not a lot of latent supply that could come online out there. Could you speak to that a little?
My understanding, you know, is that we are not making the big finds of deposits that we did at one point. Like, it requires increasingly Herculean engineering efforts to find similar amounts of oil. So, you know, in the 1940s, there were a couple like huge finds, Saudi Arabia, in the US as well, that were just like, oh my God, like we're floating in oil now as a species. I think that's not quite as true. And, you know, I think there's still tremendous amounts of oil, coal, natural gas, all the things that are sort of prerequisites for the modern society, but we have to do more work to find them and to get them. They're more dispersed. Therefore it just means it's going to be more expensive. Like, it just, the search costs are higher. And if that's the case, then, you know, the price of it should probably expect it to be somewhat higher. You never run out of anything. It's just, it becomes uneconomic to chase after it anymore at some point. So, I don't know. I mean, it's a little bit scary in some ways. Like, I'm very hopeful that humanity will make the transition from hydrocarbons to more renewable sources of energy. And I think we will get there eventually. I just think it's going to take a long time. And as an investor, if everyone thinks it's going to take a short time and you think it's going to take longer, that has often been a pretty good bet to make, is that things take longer than everyone thinks.
Yeah, I mean, even with all the sustainability initiatives going on in all parts of the world, I don't have the numbers in front of me at the moment, but it seems like oil demand kind of continues to truck upwards at maybe a couple of percent a year, something like that.
Well, one of the tough things about this whole thing, if we try to be like equitable as a species, is that there are a couple billion people on planet Earth right now who are not living their like kind of quote unquote best life because they're way down on the energy consumption curve. And at the end of the day, like, that energy is what drives how easy life is for you. Like, I'll give you a couple of numbers on this, like that I've looked up. So if you imagine that, like, the average inhabitant on Earth today has at their disposal 700 times more useful energy than their ancestors did in 1800. Okay, so what is that? It's actually like 34 gigajoules per capita is what it is. And so what does that actually mean? Like, what's that look like for us? That's the physical equivalent of the like physical labor of 60 adults working nonstop for every single person on Earth today. And they're working night and day. Basically, like, if you had a team of 60 people that were just working night and day for you to create your modern life, like, this is what it would take. And, you know, if you stripped out all of the hydrocarbons. Now, if you live in an affluent country, it's more like 200 to 250 adults who are working for you nonstop. And that's what it's providing for us. So, you know, that's really hard to undo something like that. I think it's just going to take a really long time. And if we, as like the, probably if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably in the upper half of humanity as far as like how much energy you get to use. It feels a little bit unfair to me and kind of rough that we are wanting to pull up the ladder into the tree fort, and all these other, you know, couple million people are not in the tree fort of high energy and high quality life. And we're doing it for, you know, environmental reasons. And I think the environmental reasons are totally noble. And I believe that we do need to solve this problem. It's just if you always have to ask yourself in economics, and then what? And so you ask any question, like, here's what we're going to do. Okay, well, and then what? And one of the and then what's of if we tried to get off of hydrocarbons too fast is that you are basically banishing a couple billion people to a very pretty rough life at that point. So that doesn't feel very good to me as a member of this species. And so I think we just have to be a little bit more cognizant of the physics of it, even if we all have good intentions when we show up.
Yeah, completely agree. Maybe one last question on the oil topic, and then we might jump to some Twitter questions if that's all good with you.
Yes, please.
I guess this one's more around like a valuation approach. Like you mentioned towards the start of the episode, you're kind of just sitting there waiting for things to smack you over the head, I guess, in some way. Yeah. But how would you think about valuing something as cyclical as an oil company, where earnings are up and down all over the place? Are you focusing on like a standardized measure or book value, or, you know, what kind of things flow through your mind
ideally in like that type of commodity company, you probably like buy on price to book and sell on PE. So wait until you buy when the business isn't working, assuming that you know that it's a cyclical decline and not a secular decline. And that is not always obvious. So as you know, a lot of people could attest to buying companies that they thought were just at a temporary dip and then they never come back. I know no one wants to hear that, even though, you know, we've been sort of in a buy the dip mentality for a dozen years plus, but sometimes they don't come back. So if you can untangle secular versus cyclical and you believe you're cyclical, I think buying on a cheap price to book basis can feel like you're not taking undue risk. And then when to sell, more difficult question. But I think, you know, I think you want to imagine what can the earnings look like when things are working in this business, and what would be a reasonable multiple of those earnings, and then not be too greedy about it, and not overstay your welcome if you can help it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting framework. And it seems like, you know, the likes of Buffett, I mean, he's always focused on capital allocation, but it seems like potentially even more important in this type of business, where you can do some dumb stuff when the cash really starts to flow in the door, it seems.
Oh, and the history for oil has just been laden with poor cap allocation. I mean, just you almost have to use that as the base case, like that it's going to be poorly allocated, and then, you know, work from there. But it's not everyone's found religion right now, and that's going on, but that can turn at any moment, and we can get the cowboys, you know, back out there, and they want to drill, and everything's exciting again, and it's boom times, and everyone in Houston's driving Cadillacs, and
okay, I'm gonna write that down on my checklist of when to sell oil stocks.
You know what? Honestly, it's a joke, but it might not be the worst thing that you might put in as a signpost of froth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good call. All right, let's take some questions from Twitter. So this is quite a substantial question, but Frank at Lone Wolf. So Frank's one of the guys that's on our Punch Card kind of live stream channel.
Oh, cool.
Jake explains a lot of great investing analogies, but how does it translate into his own portfolio without naming specific companies? You know, how do you think about position sizing, short term, long term, diversification, deep value, wonderful businesses, etc.? We've probably covered a bit of that. There's a lot in there, but maybe.
I got out of college answering less questions than that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. Frank is notorious for asking the tough questions, but maybe if we pull a couple of bits out of there, position sizing, diversification might be an interesting one. I don't know if we've covered that yet.
Sure. You know, I tend to aim for more diversification than probably a lot of investors would. And that's, you know, one of is part of the, to go back to what we were talking about, like I manage entire net worths of some people. So super concentration works amazing on the way up when it's working, as we've seen. And it can be that knife can cut the other direction as well and can be really painful. So, you know, my portfolio is actually, my attempt is to optimize where I'm the least wrong across all the possible ways that the world can go. That's the intention. The execution of that is obviously difficult. Like, nobody knows exactly all the ways the world can go, but I try to think about how are the different ways that the world can go and how would this portfolio be resilient against that? And maybe even more than resilient, anti-fragile. So maybe even benefiting when the world really gets rough. So, and then as far as position sizing goes, you know, if you are trying to stay humble about this, I think you have to like cut your positions back to reasonable sizes and make more bets than you would super concentrated. And anything that I would concentrate in would tend to be something where I really felt comfortable that the downside was not really in play. So, you know, it's like just a company like, let's say Berkshire, for instance, as sort of a hallmark version of this. I know that it's not a zero. I know that it's, you know, it's not going to be a home run either, but it's not a bad base load for a portfolio to, you know, earn a reasonable return on it as an owner. And, you know, there's not going to be a gotcha there that's like, oh my God, like what happened? This just, the whole thing evaporated, right? I wouldn't want to ever be in any, heavily concentrated in any company where I felt like I was taking some existential risk.
Yeah, I like it. Question here from Harry. Again, you don't have to get into specific stocks or anything here, but a question about Japan. He says you've hinted in the past that maybe that's an interesting region to look at.
Yeah, I bought individual securities in 2011, right, shortly after Fukushima, because Japan just went on absolute insane sale. Like, you know, once in a lifetime. Well, hopefully not once in a lifetime, but, you know, very generationally cheap at that point. And I bought a whole basket of companies that had been profitable for 10 straight years in a row, but yet were trading for less than the cash after all liabilities had been backed out. I mean, just ridiculous valuations, just stuff you don't see very often. So you know, obviously it doesn't always look like that. And it's gotten more expensive from there. But in general, there are things that I like about Japan in that it's still pretty cheap compared to most of the rest of the world. I think that if you think about sort of like how optimized are all the balance sheets, all of the businesses, like how much operational leverage are they running with around the world? I would say like US businesses right now that are, you know, putting off 13, 14% profit margins as a group of the S&P 500, have been buying back shares. They're pulling every single lever already, right? So where else is there to go where I'm going to get more of a return? Like, they're not going to grow much faster than GDP as a whole. They're not going to be, it's hard to imagine that they get more profitable from here, which is about 2x the long run average, which is about 6%. So where else in the world looks kind of the opposite of that? Like, where do they still have levers to pull? And that Japan has been earning terrible returns on equity for a long time. And now you're starting to see some structural foment among the insurance companies and the pensions who have been holding these companies and now are saying like, hey, when are there ever going to be returns for us owners of the business? Like, you guys need to do a better job of managing these companies. So there's starting to be some things that they can do to improve the situation there that might mean that I will do better as an investor. Whereas a lot of other places in the world, especially the US, like a lot of the levers have been pulled already, and I don't see exactly how I can win as readily. So that's something that's nice about Japan. Of course, you have just like horrific demographics. Like, there's lots of things to like keep your eye on that are troubling. But you never get everything. Like, you don't get the cheap price and perfect demographics and, you know, amazing businesses that are about to start doing better. Like, you have to sort of understand the trade-offs and understand the bets that you're making there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have heard that criticism of Japan before around the companies kind of just hoarding the cash. I think Pabrai even might have talked about that a little, but
super lazy balance sheets, right? Like, tons of cash on the balance sheets that's and just clogged up with cash, which is sounds like a good thing. I mean, if you were an owner of the business, but it's actually tends to be better if they're actually deploying that into the next project that is a positive thing. Like that's how you, that's why owning a business is such a better prospect typically than a sterile asset that doesn't have any kind of way to make itself more valuable, like art or gold or cryptocurrencies. Those don't have this internal engine like a business does where it can reinvest in the business to then create more value, which then drives the next cycle of it. And that, you know, that's how you win as owning businesses is that process. And it's not just that, you know, it's not like a this static thing. Like there's something happening inside of it that's creating more value for you.
Mm-hmm. Love it. Let's finish on this one. From Greenwald Capital, does Jake get his gelato from Costco?
Well, the secret is that I'm a no poo guy. I don't use shampoo. And how did I arrive at this? Like probably 10 years ago, I was sitting there in the shower one day, as you have these thoughts in the shower, of course. And I was using shampoo and I was like, wait a second, I'm going to like strip all the oil out of my hair right now. If an alien came down and watched this process of me stripping all the oil out of my hair, and then I go and I put another product in to replace that oil and to like make it do what I want it to do, that just seems asinine to me. Like, why am I doing this? And so I started, I stopped shampooing and stopped stripping the oil out. And everyone's worried about their hair getting greasy. And listen, like it works. I think this works better if you have really short hair like I do. I keep my hair short. But I think longer hair, this might not work. So, you know. Your mileage may vary here, but everyone's worried about their hair getting too oily if they stop shampooing. But I think what happens is the body recognizes that like there's oil enough, and then it downregulates your oil production in such a way where you don't end up with super oily hair. And so my hair just goes exactly where I want it to go without much fuss, and I don't put anything in it hardly ever. And I also don't take anything out of it. So it's very natural.
There you go. I almost guarantee the people that clicked on this podcast episode didn't think they were going to get that sort of value out of it.
Fashion tips so, and grooming advice.
Absolutely. Jake, this has been a lot of fun. Really appreciate you making the time to come on the podcast and kind of share your journey so far. For people that want to follow along with what you're doing with Farnham Street or Journalytic or anything like that,
sure.
Where can they go to check out what you're up to?
Well, definitely pleasure was all mine, Tom. I feel like we've sort of been long overdue for this conversation anyway after, you know, Omaha and different places. So I appreciate you having me on. The thing I'm most excited about right now, and obviously there's some recency bias, but like I think Journalytic is probably going to be help the most people that I can help people at scale in a way that I can't do with my other projects as much. So journalytic.com there. Farnham Street is farnham-street.com. Value After Hours is like my fun side project with my boys, Bill and Toby. And that's my favorite hour of the week is when I go record with those guys and get to tell my wife that I'm working, but really I'm just kind of hanging out with my buddies. So that's always fun. You can catch that on YouTube and wherever you get podcasts. And then the book is on Amazon in both digital and print and also audio book. And I found this guy who was, you know, because it's a story with actual characters and there's dialogue, you did not want me to be the one reading that like with my nasally voice and my no acting skills. So I found this guy who's a professional actor and voice actor, and he read it. He did all the voices, and I thought he did such an amazing job of like bringing the story to life. I couldn't have been happier with how it turned out. So, I think it goes down pretty easy is what a lot of people tell me. Like they felt like they could just like breeze through it when they listened to it. So if the book is interesting to you, that might be a good option. So yeah, that's all my stuff. And then of course on Twitter, like I tend to kind of spend more time there than I should, but I'm at FarnhamJake1 on Twitter if you want to find me there.
Awesome. Yeah. And if anyone listening or watching is interested in checking any of that stuff out from Jake, I'll leave it all linked down in the description and show notes below. But Jake, this was a lot of fun. Thank you very much. And we'll have to do this again soon.
Yeah. Thanks again.